I am here with Brian Flynn, who was the first ever guest on the pod. It's been almost 3 years since then. Now we're bringing the pod back. Brian's coming back. A lot has changed. Brian, welcome.
Yeah, Chase, thanks for having me. It has been a while. Crypto has changed a lot. So glad to be here and catch up on the latest on everything.
I feel like the entire world has shifted when it comes to crypto. Your world, my world, the rest of the space.
Yeah.
I guess before we dive into all of the craziness, maybe you can give some context on what's happened over the last 3 years. And then we can go from there in terms of from rabbit hole.
How macro picture do you want me to go? Like the entire world, the entire crypto is here, Boost. Like we can be here all day, but
I think people who are OG listeners of the show will know Rabbit Hole, but may or may not have followed the latest with Boost. And so I want to start there. And then I want to get into all of the questions around on-chain bots, hyper-financialization, incentives, all of the things.
So when we first started Rabbit Hole back in 2020, it's almost been 4 years now. The whole problem we were trying to solve was, how do we get tokens in the hands of users? How do we solve the problems of token distribution? And frankly, it's still one of the biggest problems in the space today. It's actually only become a bigger problem. The way we were doing that back in 2020 was pretty much spreadsheet tech. So we would just hit up, companies like Uniswap and Compound and Aave, sort of the blue chips at the time, and said, hey, all your token holders around centralized exchanges, let's figure out how to actually get your users tokens instead for privately using these things. And it worked in sort of getting them lots of users, educating the users. I think a lot of people have used Rabbit Hole kind of in that context of potentially as one of the first applications they've used to get into crypto. One of the things that we realized in 2 years in was for these protocols to actually be decentralized, the token distribution has to also be decentralized. So it shouldn't be the central entity who created the protocol actually distributing tokens. It should literally be anyone with tokens actually distributing those tokens to find those users who are suitable to be owners of the protocol. And so the only way to do that was essentially to create a protocol. And so Rabbit Hole was kind of unique in that we started as an application and actually shifted to building a protocol with the lessons we learned. It's actually more common that you see the opposite, which is you start with a protocol and you build an application on top of it, right? So Farcaster started as protocol and built Warpcast as a client on top. 0x started as a centralized exchange aggregator. You build Matcha on top. We kind of went the opposite way in some cases, which was difficult in the sense of like kind of our branding was all sorts of messed up, right? So we built the protocol, we called it Quest Protocol, because you create quests on it, you want this thing to be very neutral. And then we wanted other people to create other rabbit holes on top. Now, the problem was everyone called it Rabbit Hole Protocol. And I was like, that's not it, we're Quest Protocol. And so that's why we eventually said, okay, well, we need to change the name, we need to kind of clean up our branding a bit, get something where the protocol is the primary thing, we're building different applications on top. Us as Boost Studios, and then having other people also build their own clients on top. And this is very similar to the types of protocols you see today, like Farcaster, which is you have the underlying protocol where you have people building businesses on top, like Warpcast, and then you have other people also building clients on top. So we're taking a very similar path with Boost as well. The reason why we called it Boost was because we're really moving to this world of it used to be quests were this like kind of like a scavenger hunt type thing that a lot of projects did to educate their users. And that was relevant when people were first starting to get on chain. But now we're sort of entering the stage of crypto where everything is sort of being abstracted away. You're kind of already seeing that with frames. But a lot of with this cross-chain application UX and this sort of this L2 rich world, we're starting to see it be much more clear where you can just take action from pretty much any interface that you're on that is Web3 enabled. And so it will be a lot less go to this interface, go do something, and come back like you're in a rabbit hole, but Boost is much more, hey, you have these transaction offers presented to you in your interface, and you're targeted based upon your digital identity, whether you're human, whether you've done something on another protocol, whether you hold a certain asset, and you're going to be targeted with an incentive offer. And so that's what Boost is all about.
Yeah. So I just to kind of parrot some of that back, Boost is basically a protocol for incentivizing certain types of actions on chain. It can be very personalized based on an address. Boost as a protocol is building sort of the layer to actually do, like, program that type of reward. And then there are different applications and clients that can be built on top of it that can leverage it. But Boost Inbox is basically like one application where instead of having to go to a bunch of different apps, you can just do all of these things that the protocol is incentivizing you to do within the one app.
That's correct. The only minor detail is that anyone can obviously issue incentives inside of the protocol, right? And so, you know, very common, we have, you know, token issuers that want to incentivize token people to buy their token, or you have creators that want to incentivize mints. You have, we have bridges that want to incentivize usage on bridges, so there, delegates that want to incentivize delegation or governance. Like, there's a whole variety of use cases, you know, kind of depending on the action types and the script to expand, but kind of see who that person is actually wants to create the incentive is expanding over time.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to get into some of the interesting elements around incentives and rewards. I think, like, candidly, and I told you this before we started recording, I think you and I have had conversations about this. Something that I constantly struggle with around, like, rewards and incentives is just that I think often it's very hard to tell signal from noise. And I've always struggled with kind of like how rewards and incentives fit in to this like positive sum world where I'd imagine we don't want everything to be hyper financialized. And so I'm raising a bunch of different sort of unrelated concerns around what rewards look like in my head, all making them feel like a little bit icky. And so I'm curious, like, what is your utopian vision for on-chain rewards being something that, like, actually create positive sum outcomes?
Yeah, it's a great question and a good topic. I think there's two things I'll say. What makes crypto unique is tokens, right? So tokens will never go away. That is the fundamental building block. Tokens represent ownership at the end of the day, right? If everything was stable coins and crypto, then you definitely have this hyper financialized future where you're just earning dollars for doing things. But what makes crypto unique is that you're actually getting ownership for doing things, which may or may not have a dollar value assigned to things, but you need to look at first and foremost the programmable nature of those tokens, right? Because that's actually the thing that it is giving you utility inside of its networks, right? And so you kind of have to take that dollar element away from it in some cases. I don't think we can avoid the future of everything having some form of tokenization attached to it. I think it is, for better or for worse, the inevitable state of where the world goes. And so I think we have to decide is, well, what do we do with that future? What does it actually look like? How can we actually make it better for humans at the end of the day, right? So that's kind of how I view it internally is, well, these things are going to be more widespread over time. I think if you look at this cycle, even compared to last cycle, you know, the amount of hyper-financialization that's already starting to occur, just look at points and blasts and what's going on right now as sort of the case study of what the future looks like. And I think we'll just see that 10x or 100x in the next cycle as well.
Yeah, I think something that's interesting here, which I've seen you shift towards, and I increasingly have shifted towards this mental model as well. 3 years ago, when you came on the podcast and when you and I chatted, I feel like we would have had, we had a very idealistic version of the world where, like, we were very like missionaries over mercenaries. You were sort of big on this for a long time. And I think something that's interesting about the shift is that it sort of represents a a difference in, or I guess an evolution of how you see that dynamic playing out, where like actually people are going to be mercenaries. I mean, I think even like OpenSea and Blur is a great example of this, right? Like the fact that Blur was able to pick up so much usage by incentivizing people for basically their airdrop and really like won a lot of market share away from OpenSea. I mean, all of those things have happened since July 2021. And so I'm curious what that evolution in thinking looked like for you.
I think when Rabbit Hole kind of entered this like parabolic period back in 2021, 2022, and it kind of took us for a surprise of why that was actually happening. Because it wasn't really quests that were the thing that was making it get a lot of attention. It was actually XP. So we actually had XP in the product very early on, which was very similar to a lot of point systems that happen today. And what we realized was a lot of that usage was pretty much driven by speculation of an airdrop coming down the line. And so we saw that kind of in the last cycle, which is now kind of a lot of realizations that a lot of projects are having in this cycle. So we saw that very early. And that was very disorienting as a company because there wasn't many other projects experiencing that type of thing. So we kind of had that struggle internally as a company being like, hey, why is this behavior happening when no one else is really kind of talking about this? So that was kind of the first kind of main point around this. And this is kind of when we started talking about why it matters being a missionary in some cases. I think what that idealistic mindset misses that we struggled with is it doesn't actually let you build a wide user base. And at the end of the day, everyone is fighting for attention. That's like the name of the game with pretty much everything when you're building software is like you need to just build attention. Everything you're doing is casting that wide funnel and trying to create that, you know, downstream funnel to actually you're finding your believers, your missionaries in your day, right? So it kind of inverts the funnel in some way with that idealistic thinking. It's sort of saying, hey, just go find your missionaries and don't even care about missionaries. But sort of this, the latest thinking in this is that, hey, that wide distribution actually matters a lot for getting, mercenaries and actual usage. And then you kind of filter down and eventually find your missionaries over a long period of time. So this happens today with airdrops already where people are kind of going really, really wide with the airdrop. But actually, the airdrops more recently in the past 6 months have kind of getting more and more filtered over time because you're seeing all this airdrop farming type of behavior. So they're actually going to this idealistic thinking mindset, which was a few years ago, which is they're actually getting very, very targeted with who is actually receiving your tokens, then not having a way to kind of build that massive funnel in some cases. So it's kind of interesting. We're kind of seeing this tug and pull between what's happening with airdrops. And I think that speaks to a lot of the mercenary versus missionary behavior that the space has struggled with more broadly over the past few years.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's sort of like the top of funnel is mercenaries. And then the sort of as you get towards the bottom of the funnel, you figure out who the missionaries are and you reward those people, which I think is a very interesting shift from where we used to be, which was very much like, let's find the people who care. Let's reward those people. And, you know, ultimately by rewarding them, like they're not becoming missionary or mercenaries, but they're certainly like gaining the benefits that mercenaries are trying to gain all along.
Totally. And you remember this well, but there was actually a point in Rabbit Hole history in which we had a DAO, right? And our whole mindset of the DAO was essentially, hey, let's find people who are contributors to other DAOs. This was kind of in that like peak DAO era. And let's find them. Let's create ways to actually credentialize people to actually operate in these DAOs. What that model misses is it doesn't actually have those people in this funnel structure, right? You're kind of just going straight to the bottom in some cases. It's only been in the past year or so where you actually have had infrastructure that makes it easy to actually reward people with ownership that may or may not be financialized. So I know you also spoken with Shreyas from Llama, and one of those things that Llama does really well is actually creates the mechanism to actually reward people with ownership inside of a protocol that isn't necessarily a token, but actually is access rights on certain parameters in a smart contract. And what's interesting about that is we've actually been able to identify the power users of the Boost protocol and actually reward them with ownership for actually doing things like token whitelisting, voting on how a treasury is used. So things that are very specific to the protocol on a very on-chain level, they're able to actually understand the protocol by being a user and then make decisions on what's best for the protocol. Those things just didn't exist in the last cycle. So now we're getting to the point where you can actually create that funnel, identify who those power users are, and give them ownership to make decisions relative to the protocol. And so even as we start to think about this thing about missionaries and ownership, governance is kind of at the intersection of those things. And we're already starting to see that protocol teams in this cycle are thinking about governance very differently this cycle, right? They realize that the token voting mechanism of one token, one vote doesn't fit everything, but actually it can be used as just voting on a very specific parameter. You need actually other voting mechanisms to make decisions on other things as well. So that's been an interesting shift in this cycle, is just seeing a lot more teams experiment with different types of ownership structures and governance.
Yeah. I think a primary difference that stands out for me here is in the earlier 2021 era of a lot of this stuff, to your point, it was very much like, how do we attract the right people? How do we make sure that people aren't botting this system? How do we give real humans ownership? And now we're moving a little bit more towards this paradigm of like, how do we accept the reality that there are mercenaries? And then how do we basically figure out who we think is actually the right set of people to be governing or to get tokens or whatever it is? And I think the interesting dynamic there is like, for some reason, I think partially it's because of the way that Boost is like a protocol where all these things are programmable. And you do have this funnel where it's like, all these things are just on-chain addresses. They're not people. The thing that I started to move towards that you and I have talked a little bit about is like, okay, well, now we have the system where these things are totally programmable. In theory, you could have humans that do all this stuff that like, end up getting governance, and that's great, and they get to help make decisions. The other side of this is like, the reality is you could have bots that are both missionaries and mercenaries that actually help govern these things. And so where I think some of this leads is basically like, how do we think about like AI agents that just like do things on chain that actually fit the criteria for a missionary as well? So I'm curious how you think about bots, basically like non-human addresses that participate in these things and do earn ownership by our own standards of this like programmable, on-chain reward system where we want, in theory, the people who are the things that are bots to actually be governing because they meet the criteria.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So for some history here, which you kind of mentioned a little bit, but there is early on in rabbit hole history, we used a mechanism called BrightID to actually filter out users to say if they're a human or not, kind of use this trust web to qualify users if they were human or not in order to get rewards. It just didn't work after some level of scale when rabbit hole kind of hit this inflection point. They were actually using Zoom rooms to verify users very manually. Now you have things like
Passport
and WorldCoin that kind of do this in a little better form. But the cool thing about Boost is it's kind of agnostic to humans or bots, right? So we have this allow list mechanism that's kind of used for targeting. And you can target, say, WorldCoin users who are verified on chain. People have Bitcoin passports, so it's kind of up to you. But you can also remove the whitelist entirely for a Boost, and which you're basically it's open for bots, right? So we see both strategies used when people are actually creating Boost. We see people that actually want to incentivize bots to do things. When you see people actually want to more specify humans. Now, the interesting thing about Boost is that some protocols like to use bots, And the reason I like to use bots is because number go up, right? It's a very mercenary mindset, but it's something that a lot of protocols just want at the end of the day is I put tokens in the vending machine and I see my number going up at the cheapest possible cost, right? Now, there's debate whether that's actually effective or not, or whether that's just, you know, some metric that is vanity. But then you see this other side, whereas people say, hey, I actually want to target humans and that are most likely humans, but it's actually very hard to know if they're a human or not. It's still a problem today, right? So Gitcoin Passport obviously aggregates different credentials together and gives you a trust score and you can say, hey, trust me as Gitcoin Passport, as this person human. Of course, a lot of airdrop farmers are also farming those passports to kind of get like who is the customer in the day. But the point is we see both, right? It's interesting how a lot of the bot behavior is very relevant when they know what the reward is that they're getting, right? So for example, in airdrop farming, it's very hard for bots to operate because they don't necessarily know how much reward they're getting for doing a task on chain, right? With MEV, they actually know what the reward is they're getting if it's casted into the mempool, right? And it's actually a very similar case for Boost, right? And I always make the joke that Boost is kind of like an MEV business in which, because they actually know what the reward is that they're getting for doing that action on chain. And actually, whenever we see that the reward is greater than the gas cost, that there are bots that will do the action on chain if there isn't an allow list, right? But then it gets to this question, which you're kind of hinting on, which is, you know, what does this world look like with autonomous agents? I think we haven't fully seen how that plays out yet, but at least we're starting to see this world of bots and humans kind of coexisting in this digital economy with crypto. And we're still in, I would say, like top of the first inning on how this sort of plays out. But it is becoming a darker forest, as some might say.
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, today the reason that bots are and that MEV bots are possible, and to your point that Boost, it's possible to bot when you know the rewards on Boost, is just like you have one single optimization function, which is like what makes me the most money, basically, in, let's say, US dollar terms. I do kind of wonder if like we're going to move towards a world where the optimization function for these bots is no longer, you know, what makes me the most money in the short term, and is instead something along the lines of like, okay, well, what gets us to the best governance outcome here? And is like much longer term. Obviously, that's like much more nuanced in terms of how do you define the best outcome for governance and how do you do these things? But part of me does kind of wonder like how much of on-chain activity is going to be a result of being able to have bots that have defined outcomes that are much less optimized for money oriented and much more optimized for the best possible outcome for this DAO oriented. And like, is that a lot of does that ultimately end up being a lot of the quote unquote volume or activity on Boost itself?
It's a good question. I think one of the things that I would ask is what does successful governance in terms of governance outcome actually look like? Because I think most people would say it's revenue generation for the protocol in some cases, right? Or even maximizing TVL in some cases, right? But it's at that point, it's still the best way to get to that outcome is to incentivize single bots or humans, doesn't really matter, addresses to go take actions for an incentive. So it's still very much a single player monetary outcome if you're trying to still get this collective outcome on the other side. So I don't know if there is a ways to avoid it necessarily, but it is interesting to think about. I know there are a lot of teams working on using AI as part of the governance stack right now to help make decisions. I think we're still, again, in early stages of that.
Yeah, and it kind of also just underlines this like really funny dynamic to me in general, which is that a lot of on-chain activity is kind of, it's very hard to distinguish between bots and humans, ultimately. I mean, that's the core problem that like, quote unquote airdrop farming is addressing, or I guess is getting at. Which kind of makes me wonder, like, what does that say about the industry? The fact that, like, we actually have a hard time telling the difference between users and bots. And, like, maybe it's totally fine. Again, maybe bots are actually ultimately very helpful and we're able to create optimization functions that are net positive for humans. But it is kind of like an eerie and weird observation about the space.
It is weird for sure. And I think we're going to see even probably more bot activity happen with after 4844. As we sort of approach zero, it's going to be less risk for bots to also do, like, have on-chain activity. So I think the end state of all this, which we're kind of getting, which you're kind of, you're alluding to, is reputation is going to finally matter for on-chain addresses, right? I think there was a group of people back, you know, in sort of many years ago, or digital identity matters. And I think how that's panned out for many years is really, hey, digital identity doesn't really matter because everyone just uses many addresses, right? And as we're now approaching this, like, bot heavy world, as fees approach zero, now digital identity is going to start to mean a little bit more, right? Because it's not going to be about how many addresses are using your application, but it's going to be how many quality users are using your application. I know it's something that Dan from Farcaster, you know, talks about a lot, but defining quality isn't a very, you know, standardized metric across the board. So I think once we reach that point, it's going to be sort of now everyone's going to just take advantage of this bot activity, and we're going to need to find different ways to actually find what does actually the quality user mean and create new benchmarks. It's very similar to how the early internet actually started, where a lot of early internet businesses really cared about page views as the primary metric, you know, sort of like pre-Facebook days. And so everyone was now just like, you know, control R and just trying to refresh as much as possible and just finding ways to bring new traffic to the page, when they weren't actually taking downstream actions, in which then it became metrics like DAU that actually took over after some period of time. So we were kind of using the same metric that we created, you know, with sort of the Facebook era, and now we need to find the new metric that measured activity outside of bot activity, essentially. So whatever that new metric is, I think is something the industry that can push it forward to the next level.
It's also kind of interesting, and this is getting into, like, a much more abstract territory, but, like, I think the other interesting dynamic here is actually that, like, so there's quality users, which could be defined as humans, but, like, there's also a world in which there are protocols that primarily serve bots, or that, like, let's say 50% of protocol volume is bots, but those bots are basically, like, servicing humans ultimately, which is the case, like, for most bots. I mean, people pay to build and deploy and run bots because it is servicing some human, like Sisyphus famously, bot stuff, people say. Like, that is an interesting dynamic. And so, like, there's also a funny element here where actually, like, value is not defined exclusively by quality users, but instead by, like, how much, you know, consumer surplus is there for users, plus how much bot surplus is being created for individual users. And maybe that's more a concentration of, like, you know, whale type of users who are leveraging bots. I don't know. I think it's interesting, but, like, my gut intuition on this is also that there will definitely be importance of on-chain reputation identity, which we'll talk about. But the other side of this is that, like, ultimately bots are also serving humans, at least today. We'll see if that's the case in the future.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's already true with paying for ChatGPT to execute tasks on our behalf, essentially, right? And so I think you're totally right. I think what's difficult about the current status quo is that crypto and AI are sort of these very separate worlds still, because you're still reliant on paying for these models with sort of Stripe and all these credit card processors. They're not really, the credit system hasn't really found its way on chain yet to figure out how to pay for compute into these models. And I think until we find that, then we won't really have this way to interact with autonomous agents. I know there are a lot of teams working on it, but that really creates this bridge between crypto and autonomous agents, in which then you're actually able to pay for their services and they're just part of this economy where they're then serving humans. But I think that's what you're getting at. And I'm really excited for that future as well. And I think this maybe is part of Sam's master plan with WorldCoin and OpenAI, who knows? Yeah, I'm definitely excited for that future.
Well, it is kind of an interesting thought experiment, because when you think about okay, so how do we get humans and bots to work together? You need some way of speaking to one another, basically. You need some mechanism for organizing bot resources or AI resources or whatever. And I do think there's a very interesting world in which crypto is the medium because it is money. And again, the optimization function for money is so simple. It's not values-based, really. I mean, it can be, but it is simply MEV bots run this and optimize for how much ETH you can get, or it is, you know, do activity on Boost and as a result gain ownership over certain protocols. And then to your point, optimize for revenue. I think you're totally right about AI and crypto coming together. And it kind of feels true to me that crypto is one of the only ways for us to be able to interface effectively with bots in the short term.
Yeah, no, totally. I don't have much to add to that. I think you've nailed it.
Okay, I want to talk in that world about why on-chain reputation matters and how we get to that point. You talked about we need some sort of catalyst for things like credit, being able to do these types of things. Yeah. I feel I don't know that I'm sold that we're at the point where we've hit okay, on-chain reputation definitely matters now. Maybe I get the sense that you think we've hit a point where we're almost there and we really need on-chain reputation, but I'm curious what that catalyst is.
So the catalyst, in my opinion, of what we're seeing in the market is airdrops have kind of reached this point in the cycle, and we kind of look at airdrops as wherever airdrops are kind of defined sort of the market structure, because that's where capital is actually inflowing into the market and the token is being generated. They reach this point in the cycle, which they're being very, very specific on who is actually receiving the tokens, right? So let's take the Uniswap airdrop as a very simple example, right? Uniswap's airdrop was very, very simple. As anyone who has used it before this date, wasn't much more complicated than that. Now what you're seeing with a lot of airdrops in L2 is things like you must have interacted with this network or protocol in the X amount of times and Y amount of days. You must have used this other protocol in this other network who it has also helped us. You must have also been a GitHub contributor to these three or five different repositories. And you might live in a certain country. You might have to have a certain attestation using EAS, and the list goes on and on. You're actually seeing these things become much more specific over time, in which the airdrop farmers, it's not even beneficial to be in a farmer anymore because it's just so hard to predict what the qualifications are in some cases, which has led to this points meta being this way of sort of testing out these sorts of these things, right? And that meta is also already starting to die. I start to feel that, see for what it's worth. But I think the point is we're getting more specific about who is eligible to receive these things over a period of time. Because what these protocols know is they know what type of culture they want to create with their network. So they're going to find those addresses that they think represent that culture and give them ownership. And so now it's much more beneficial to have one address where you're building up a lot of activity on it over a period of time versus creating a new address. Whereas in a previous cycle, for if you're playing a single player game, you're trying to extract as much value as possible, it's a much higher ROI to create many addresses and try to just farm the protocol as much as possible, right? No longer beneficial to do that. So that's kind of why I think this is kind of an inflection point for digital identity, and we'll start to see digital identity starting to matter, at least in terms of being able to distribute tokens, which, you know, again, I think is still one of our biggest problems that we have as a space.
Interesting. Okay, so basically, this is a very interesting argument. It's essentially that protocols actually care about culture, let's call it protocol culture. So if you're Zora, you have a very different sort of set of addresses and on-chain activity that you're looking for to find relevant on-chain entities to be part of what you're doing, which is very different from like what, you know, a Synthetics or, you know, some other DeFi protocol cares about, or even like Hyperliquid, let's say. And so your argument is that effectively, like in that context, you want way more data on what addresses have done. And so actually, in a way, like having not only a longer history of what you've done on chain and just more things with the single address is important, but actually like those things kind of compound to serve as like your proof of culture, basically, at an individual level.
Yeah, and this is the case for having this public open data graph attached to your address, right? You with having Farcaster, you know, attached to your address, for example, you can actually see which channels someone follows or you post in, right? And that's a whole new data set that wasn't even possible before. So we're starting to even see protocols. You're like, I actually want to target people who are posting about these things in Web3 social contexts, right? Because they know that information is also helpful for us. And so protocols are thinking about, well, what is this natural end state we want to get to? What are the types of people that we want to help govern the protocol? And how do we target them and reach them to start participating in our ecosystem? And that's the kind of use case that we're seeing in Boost already, where people are using this targeting mechanism of Boost to target the types of people they want to actually interact with their protocol, and then seeing how they retain over some period of time. So I think as we start to see the social layer get built out, I think that social, the cultural element will become an even bigger part of this reputation layer that we haven't seen before.
It is kind of interesting because it's occurring to me that like, 3 years ago, a lot of this stuff just wouldn't have been possible because there wasn't enough to do on chain to develop a personality around it. Like you could swap and you could deposit and compound, and maybe you could like have, you know, like bred crypto kitties or whatever, but like you couldn't build an entire personality around those things. But like to your point, as more and more things, you know, come on chain, as you can mint random specific mints on Base and post in specific channels on Farcaster and do random, very degenerate shit on different, you know, perps, exchanges and things, like you actually can start to build a much more comprehensive understanding of who someone is, what they care about, and like build an identity that has a lot more depth.
Yeah, no, that's totally right. I think you're already starting to see applications built around on-chain social graphs. So who's actually minting what on Zora, who's following who on Farcaster, and joining that with transaction activity and wallet holdings across the board. So you're totally right. It didn't exist last cycle. It's very much a new behavior. Something people have talked about for years, for what it's worth. It's kind of no different what people were starting to predict back in 2020. Just we're now starting to see that infrastructure and applications come into play. So it feels very similar to the types of things people want to do in a 2020 cycle, but now we're actually starting to see those things be a lot more legitimate.
Yeah, the other interesting thing that this brings up for me is like we've talked a little bit about governance, about like ownership and all of these things. Something that feels true for me that's bubbling up is just like governance minimization. I feel like that's a meta right now that I imagine will continue, which is just like, I mean, you and I have talked a lot about DAOs. I've thought a lot about DAOs. I continue to follow that space. Like, I think I'm very curious to see, you know, as we think about like, how do different protocols curate the culture of their protocol and choose people to own it? Like, how much is governance actually the reason that they're doing it versus like wanting to have owners who are just aligned with the vision and actually automate a lot of governance so that people don't need to actively govern it, but at least you are an owner and receive some maybe benefit, maybe not, of being an owner. And so I'm curious how you think about like basically the way that ownership and like this whole governance minimization trend sort of fit together. Are there other benefits of ownership that you see? I'm curious your take on all of that.
Yeah, I think it's an abstract topic, but what I'll say is, I think it depends on the protocol. I don't think every single protocol can follow governance minimization. I'll just give you an example from Boost, because I think that's kind of what I'm living, breathing every single day. So I mentioned we use Llama, which uses access control for certain parameters. And the way Llama works is that we have certain roles inside of the DAO that determines what they can actually access. One thing that they can actually do inside of the DAO is that they can whitelist which tokens can be used inside of the protocol. And this is the moderator role. So we actually have moderators that actually are looking at what types of tokens are being inserted to the protocol and saying this one is verified, this one's unverified, pretty much like how a TCR would operate. Remember token created registries, things people talked about many years ago, right? So you have a group of moderators who are just checking this registry to say, hey, is this a verified token, this unverified token? Is this a scam? Is this not a scam? In that world, you actually do want very active governance, right? It's not your traditional governance of everything is put for a snapshot proposal for all the token voters, which is governance apathy, but it's a group of people who are already moderating the Discord, right? And already very familiar with the protocol. And are now making decisions on, hey, should we allow this or should we not, right? So it's very defined into their role. So I think that's just an example of, so it does depend on the protocol, whether you do want governance minimization or not. There are some cases where you do want very active user base to make decisions on if this is something that the protocol should have or not.
Interesting. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And also, I just think a big plus one on specialists governing specific parts of protocols as opposed to having generalized token governance that tends to create a lot of voter apathy. I mean, and I guess just to pull it back, like that's where I also think like I'd be curious if, you know, what does it look like to have like bots that do token curated registries that are like actually really effective at their job, and, you know, some random girl in her basement is ultimately, you know, making sure that the compute is there for them to do their job. But like, maybe these agents just act on behalf of people.
It's something that I see in the space and we talk about all the time is using autonomous agents for actually deploying Boost, right? So they'll actually do all the parameter creation, who should be targeted for the task, especially if the agent already knows what the end outcome should be. In fact, you know, I think a lot of internal team of analysts who are creating these for other protocols are already using AI as part of their workflow. The thing that is difficult is actually giving the agents the keys to actually make the transactions, actually giving them permission to go execute without having a human in the loop to press the button saying, yes, this looks right. Right. I think things can get a little bit haywire if you kind of take the human out of the loop and say you need some checks and balances, at least in the kind of the current state of things. Otherwise, things are not at the stage where you can trust an AI fully, especially with all hallucination that goes on with AI and with the current models.
I mean, I guess I'll ask a follow-up question to that, which is like, do you think we'll ever get to a point where we can trust AI? And I'll paint a vision of a future where this is scary, is that like, it turns out, you know, somehow AI agents are able to interact with Boost, maybe using resources from someone who kind of knows what's going on, but doesn't totally understand. And, you know, the doomsday scenario happens where AI agents are able to earn a lot of ownership over protocols and ultimately end up running with their own set of optimization parameters and things. And like, we actually don't have a lot of control because we give them signing power and like, oops, now all the bots have airdrop farmed and are in control of all of our money, you know, like. I don't know. I paint the doomsday scenario because it does feel like it could happen. And I'm curious if you think we'll ever be able to trust bots, or if that will always be like a potential scenario that we're so afraid of that we can't allow these agents to act like fully autonomously.
It's a good question. I think there will always be this gray area of how much this bot is actually operating on its own versus having some input from human. They can probably see more customized models for specific functions and protocols, for example, that maybe make that less biased. I'm not fully sure how it's going to play out, right now. But again, I think we're still in such early innings that it's kind of hard to see what the end result of some of the stuff may be.
Well, I'm very eager to see how it turns out. Brian, I'm curious as we wrap up, what is your like biggest prediction for 2024 for crypto that like feels exciting and net new?
I think there's probably two things. I think there's one, I think as gas fees approach zero, I think it's going to be much more prevalent that we're going to see this world of chain abstraction that people have been talking about for so long, which is completely hiding the crypto UX from the user experience. So I think we'll finally see that UX world that everyone's been talking about since 2018 finally come to life. And I think the second one is, I do think a lot of people in crypto are underrating AI and its impact in crypto overall. And so I think as soon as someone figures out how to join these two worlds together, we'll see a lot of stuff that you and I have been talking about in this conversation come true, which is having AI agents be operating in this digital economy. So I'm really excited for that as well. I think that may take a little bit longer, but it's definitely not too far out in the future.
Yeah. And I think the most interesting thing there is just that, like, my underlying assumption, which is probably wrong, but is that like, if there's money to be made, people figure out how to do it. And like I said, I think like crypto creates such a clear universal language for an optimization function that I could see people very quickly experimenting with and figuring out how to use AI to leverage it.
Yeah.
And I guess at that point, as we wrap this up, I feel like when I think about incentives, when I think about all of this stuff, the primary question that I have for myself and for you is like, how do we make it so that the incentives that we lay out are actually net positive, so that no matter who is acting, whether it's a human or an agent, we feel good about the outcome. And like, maybe it's not possible to do that, but I'm curious if you have a take on how to make sure that incentives optimize for the types of behaviors that are actually positive rather than creating this like weird dystopia.
Oh, this is a perfect show point for Boost. I'll be honest, because I think a lot of what we're trying to do is build a protocol for people to optimize their incentives over a period of time, right? To see who actually is performing that is a net positive to the network and who is actually taking from the network in some cases, really thinking of Boost as an incentive sandbox, right? And so we have protocols constantly using Boost to optimize their incentives. And so I think it's the type of tool that people want to use part of the toolkit when thinking about how to distribute incentives correctly, finding that types of missionary users that are going to make the protocol more sustainable.
Beautiful. Well, thanks for coming back on the show, Brian.
Yeah, thank you, Chase. Thanks for having me.